Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Barbican Station.
Hello and welcome back to Barbican Station. We are here to talk about episode 4 of season 3, adapting the book Real Tigers. And I am pleased to welcome back Gary to the show to talk about this one. I think it's a great one to talk through. Gary, thanks for joining me again.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be back.
So, wow, what an episode. I mean, you know, jumping to the end, it really leaves you on like a cliffhanger ending here, huh?
Yeah, it certainly does. Yeah, they're very good at that in this adaptation. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you're on the edge of your seat waiting. It's like, why aren't we not watching the next episode immediately?
Absolutely. Yeah, I wish they'd drop them in one block and then we could binge it.
I mean, I'm really excited to go into the final two episodes after that. So it's going to be a wild ride to see what happens here, because we definitely see River and Louisa in the crosshairs. I'm just a little nervous about how that's going to shake out for them, got to be honest.
yeah, no doubt. They're both very, very good at personifying the tension.
Yeah.
And the pace of the writing accelerates. It's impressive.
Well, you know, jumping back to the beginning, I really liked the start of this episode because it's just a complete reversal to what we saw. Was it just last episode? I think I'm getting my episodes mixed up now, but where Tierney goes to Judd and is basically hat in hand, ready to resign. And now we have a complete reversal because his Tiger team has gone rogue. So that was really fun to watch her kind of twist the knife in his back a little bit, similarly to what she had done to her.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, complete reversal of the power structure. Yeah, they play it so well. I mean, they're such masters of their craft, and they really express that. It was very, very enjoyable. It's kind of a comeuppance thing.
Yeah, well, and Judd, I just loved how he was so... More than the Tiger team going rogue, he was just irritated that they dumped a body in front of his favorite restaurant.
Yes.
And he's like, I know the owner and I'm one of the investors, but that's not the point, even though that's exactly the point.
Absolutely. And in fact, that mirrored a little bit what he'd said about being on the board of Chieftain in the previous episode as well, and also said that's beside the point.
Yes.
So privileged and elitist.
Well, and I noticed that this episode, does he have a portrait of himself in his own office? It looked like that was there. I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah, it appears so. This is my second watch, and I missed that first go round.
It just brings everything home with Judd. I mean, he's such a sleazy, sleazy politician. It's really great.
He really is. I mean, Samuel West is perfect casting. It was interesting because when it was announced, you know, I think we all probably had the Boris Johnson cipher in our minds, and they don't play it so much like that in the show. And honestly, I think it's better for it. I really enjoy him in that role.
Yeah, well, and I mentioned last episode, even Heron is kind of backed away from that a little bit, just because, you know, unfortunately for him, events kind of overtook his caricature there. So it made it hard to keep going that way. So I think he's kind of pivoted a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's an interesting thing on both sides of the Atlantic where we can no longer keep up with the real-life caricatures.
One of the things that Tierney decides to do out of all of this is she's going to let the Tiger team into the facility to really just put Judd over a barrel, lay this all at his feet, make it so that she's the one in the power position. And she tells that to Diana Taverner, who's not exactly loving that, since she's the one in charge of the facility.
Yes, definitely. And Diana's always looking out for herself, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, as you say, looks decidedly nervous.
Although I think, you know, as we get to the end of the episode, we see that maybe all is not as it appears with her and that, right? I mean, you definitely get the sense that there are wheels within wheels going on here. And Tierney has finally figured out what might really be going on.
Yeah, 100%. Yes. I don't think they do the Lady Di nomenclature in the show, if I'm remembering rightly, do they?
I feel like Lamb has said it a couple of times.
Probably. I've probably just missed it. But it's definitely less pervasive than the books. But in any case, yeah, you said it well. I couldn't say it better. Wheels within wheels. Christian Scott Thomas is fantastic at expressing that as well.
Yeah. We get back to Slough House because, you know, I really love the scenes where we have the group in Slough House together. This episode is no different. We get Lamb coming in there and basically figuring out where Catherine is, thanks to a little bit of Catherine assisting there,
yes.
Right? You know, because she's kind of pointing over to the, with her eyes, to the notches on the wall where they were measuring these kids. And yep. That's how they can kind of figure out where she's at. because, you know, Roddy is like, oh, I figured out where Chieftain has their safe houses. They're probably this. And he's like, yeah, except they're not with Chieftain anymore. Otherwise, they'd have found it already. So Lam already ahead of things. And I just love the kind of puppy dog eagerness that we get from River, where he's trying to tell Lam about Spider being actually the one behind all this. And Lam's like, I'm past that already.
Yeah, they do that a lot in this adaptation, I think. I've seen it happen at least a couple of times before, where Lam's, in fact, at least one step ahead of them. And there's a moment where they'll make that statement and then he'll reveal that. And it's always funny.
Lam does not care one bit about Spider being dead.
Which is good, because neither do we.
Yes. No, I mean, it's really funny. I mean, and Spider had a great episode last episode. He went out with a real bang. I loved that performance. But, you know, it's like moving on here. They're kind of like, okay, he's gone. We're gonna move on to the next problem.
Yeah, it's so true. And that's the thing. They've cast this so well and with so much talent that when a character leaves us, you're always disappointed to have lost their contribution, because it's such an ensemble piece and it works so well with that level of talent. So when you lose the character, you're like, oh, that's too bad.
But we have, you know, this episode, especially the past few, we have Marcus and Shirley really stepping to the forefront, I feel, in a way that they didn't necessarily last season. And I've just loved every bit of the two of them together. I mean, they are like the partner setup that you love, right? I mean, isn't it great?
Yeah, I totally agree. They're like a buddy cop type dynamic, but they don't get any closer. They remain highly antagonistic.
We see them first in this episode. They're fighting in the car, right? Because Lam has just told them they're both fired. And I just love that. That whole sequence was great, because Marcus doesn't think he's fired because Shirley was the one that was caught with the coke. And they just get, you know, there's some great lines in there. Like, Shirley's like, no one can tell when I'm high. And then Marcus is like, you do realize that's a bad thing?
Yes. Yeah.
And then they start talking, they're betting on whether they were both fired or just one of them, right? Because, like, Marcus can't turn down a bet. And it's just, all of it was so funny.
Yeah, it really was. And they're both so blind to their own character flaws. That's what makes it so great, I think. I also enjoy the constant criticism of Marcus's musical text.
Yes.
I mean, from Shirley.
Well, and then they do get to Lam finally and do find out that they're both fired. And that's kind of where we leave them this episode, just kind of in limbo, because he's like, clear out your desks. And if they're not, you know, I'll set fire to them both and you. So, you know, he's like really just had enough of the two of them, which is just like, you can tell Marcus is just kind of having a mini freak out right behind his eyes. You get to see he is like completely losing his mind right now.
Yeah, no, very true. I always wondered whether Lam was genuinely firing them or whether it was actually the interpretation that they come up with, whether he was essentially playing chess with them and trying to find a way to motivate them to be useful.
Yeah. I just love them. I hope we see more in the coming couple episodes with the two of them working together, because it's so great. But jumping back to Catherine, I thought this was a really nice episode with her and Donovan. They have that really nice scene there where Donovan kind of lays it all out. And the thing about Catherine and the thing about the actress playing her that's so well is that you can tell that she's a listener. She's somebody who can empathize with people. And that's kind of her superpower on the show. And so it's like almost like the captors are caring more about her. You know, it's like a reverse Stockholm syndrome, right? Where the captors are caring about her versus her caring about the captors.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Yeah, she's got superhuman soft skills. Yeah, Saskia Reeves is fantastic in that role. And people are obviously highly dismissive of Catherine at their peril. She's actually far more competent than the characters give her credit for. And you really see that in this episode.
Yeah. I think the only one that has a place to be kind of disdainful of her is Lam, I would say. But that's just because of his own kind of thing. Everybody else who puts her to the side does so incorrectly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Agree.
They have this moment, you know, because Donovan is trying to get this file that Allison had. We get this background that, you know, it was actually Sarah, Allison's sister, that kind of pulled them back together. He really is an alcoholic. That was all true. And, it was really great. But then all of a sudden, it's like that moment is broken because the chieftain guy that they locked up in the barn or whatever gets away. And it leads to this chase through the forest. And you're like, man, these kidnappers are like the slow horses of kidnappers, right? They're just like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. They're just not really pulling it off here. I'm not feeling good for their odds.
100%. And you spend a couple of episodes waiting for that moment, because when they lock him up, you're thinking, that's not very secure. Yeah. That's not going to contain him. So when it happens, you're like, well, we were waiting for this.
Yes. He gets in a car with some French tourists or something, right? Is that right? I mean, he's like, just get out of here. He's like, I mean, I can't imagine being the tourist there, that you see some guy in handcuffs come running out of the forest and you're like, okay, hop in. Right. But okay, you know, I guess it takes all kinds.
Yeah, I've certainly never had that experience myself, and hope not to.
But we get to the moment where Catherine, again, she gives up the room where this file is hidden. Did you buy that as a character moment for her? Because, like, you know, she's hearing the other two talk, and so she kind of gives in and gives them that location. What do you think about that?
I didn't really buy it, actually. I thought it was a rare weak moment in the show. It didn't seem in keeping with her character's behavior. Yeah, maybe we'll see additional reasons for that down the road. But yeah, it was a bit, I did think it was a little bit weak that moment.
Well, and you know, the other thing was, at the very beginning of that scene, we see Donovan, you know, she's not giving him what he wants. And she's saying, you won't hurt me. But yet we just saw him take out Spider, right? In that vicious moment where he didn't even realize what he was doing and what he had done, because he's like, you know, still thinking he's alive, right? And that was just like,
yeah.
This moment of violence, you know, this guy is kind of like, you can't necessarily trust that he is just a good guy. And so that reversal where he does open himself up a little bit, I thought that worked really nicely.
Yes, I do too. I mean, my read of Donovan is he was completely out of control. Now, of course, Spider in that previous episode scene was provoking him intensely, and probably would have provoked an angel into similar behavior. But yeah, as you say, it wasn't intended, though. It was just a product of his training and his strength, I guess. But yeah, he definitely looks like a man on the edge.
Yes, I don't know where that's going to go, but it's probably going nowhere good is the feeling that you get there. And you get the sense, too, right? Because they're having this conversation, you know, I'm going to be the one that's jailed for killing him, not you, all of that. You get the sense that this is like the end of the road. He doesn't see a way for himself to kind of make it through this. You know, once he gets what he needs, that's kind of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quote unquote a suicide mission for him. He's completely obsessed with getting what he wants.
Back at Slough House, River gets a call to go to his grandfather's club because he's there thinking that he can get in. And it just leads to this really very sad scene with River's grandfather, where you can tell he's just losing himself, right? And this is the guy who is, you know, we've seen be very with it and competent in previous seasons. It's pretty hard seeing him struggling like we see him here.
Yeah, definitely. It was, you know, I have a bit of personal experience with that with family, and it was portrayed very well. The only thing I would say is that it was quite sudden, because we saw David Cartwright kind of still at the peak of his powers, as it were, even in retirement in the previous season, and now we see this. So it was kind of seemingly a bit sudden, the onset of that level of decline, but the way it was portrayed was, you know, it was full of pathos. It was genuinely sad.
Yeah. It does start out with a nice little bit where River's grandfather says, what's wrong with your face? And River says, filing accident. I thought that worked pretty well.
Yeah.
And the other part of it is that at the club, he gets that call from Tierney. And I wonder, you know, it's so funny because previously Tierney had tried to get Lam to do this and, you know, go meet Donovan at the spot where they're holding the files, right? The gray books, and show him in there. And Lam is not going to fall for it because he knows that there's something up. There's some sort of trickery that she's planning on. And so
he
says no. And then River, of course, immediately says yes, right? Because he can't not do that. He agrees to do it. And there's this nice moment where he's like kind of explaining it to his grandfather. And his grandfather is like, well, you know, you already said yes. I know that. So you're just trying to make me feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. So not completely helpless.
Yes. Yeah, no, that was pretty funny. Well, and it plays well into that later scene where we see River and Louisa talking in the car before they go to that facility. And they finally kind of talk about Min and what happened, because we didn't really see that. You know, there wasn't really a discussion about what happened with Min and we get Louisa to kind of open up and talk about it, even though she really doesn't want to, right?
No, that's right. It seems that that's her way of processing the grief, is just to bury it down. And yeah, doesn't want to talk about it. And really, the only other exchange about it, of course, happens with Spider's classic insensitivity. And yeah, there's been no serious discussion about it until that point.
Well, and River has obviously got his grandfather going through his mind there as well, as he's trying to talk to her about that. It worked for me because it had so many levels, you know, and ebbs and flows to the conversation. You know, Louisa doesn't want to have this conversation. She pushes back. She eviscerates River, right? I mean, she just lays out all of his, like everything wrong with him and everything that we know about him, but just cuts him down. Man, you know, he doesn't know who his father was. His mother left him. His grandfather raised him to be this perfect person that he can't live up to. His, you know, his impulsivity, all of that, and just like knocks him down about, not a peg, but like about 12 pegs, I felt.
Yeah, it's pretty cutting.
But at the same time, he doesn't give up, right? He keeps going forward, talking through this with her, and it does work. You know, you get the sense that there is this kind of connection between the two of them, and he gives her the most awkward hug ever.
It was priceless. Yeah, it's the sort of hug that I give people. I'm not very good at them.
Yes, I'm right there. I'm right there with you. I'm not a good hugger. But it was fun to just see that and have that moment. You know, you get the sense that this is kind of the calm before the storm, right? You know, they're gearing up for what is probably going to be a crazy final couple episodes here. And this was a kind of a chance to take a deep breath, think about the characters, give them those moments to kind of talk about what's going on and then move on.
Yeah, 100%. I wondered also in that exchange whether there was the subtext around what had happened to Sid back in season one, you know, with River.
That's what I was initially thinking of before he kind of pivots to his grandfather, where you get the sense that that's what he's talking about, and specifically there.
I wondered, in fact, whether the intent was he was using the events with his grandfather's decline as a way to mask the fact that he, you know, had similar trauma to process around Sid's misfortune.
Yeah. The reason they're in this car is because Louisa has kind of invited herself along on the River's mission to be his backup, you know, and she immediately grabs a gun that she's kept ever since Min died. River's like, well, I'll take the gun. She's like, no, you can make yourself a little sheriff's badge if that makes you feel tougher. She gets some good zingers in this one.
She does. She was consistently condescending to River all along.
That was great to see them. And so the two of them meet Donovan. And it's so funny because they go and there's that moment, right, where they're supposed to pat them down. You know, she's like, you know, raise your arms. And then Donovan's like, well, okay, anyone? And then Louisa's like, I'm not doing it. She's just consistently just putting River down, which is just so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoy her performance, actually.
Yeah. She had a really good episode, this one. And
yeah.
I love how when they do go to the bunker, right, we get our nerd back again, Douglas. I'm nominating him as MVP of this episode. Sean Daniel Young is the actor. He's like making so much the most of this part, right?
He absolutely is. I his face is familiar to me, but I don't know where I've seen him before. But his performance is priceless. I mean, it's so like naturalistic but comedic. It's really good.
I mean, he starts giving River, because he knows River, he's like, your filing skills are shit, you know? It's just so funny. Such a weird dude. Like, it's such a great character, but he's really making it his own. And like the moments that he's on screen, you're like, okay, I'm enjoying this a lot.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And they made more of that character than is in the book, from what I remember. I remember the character having moments in the book, but he's definitely had a meatier part here, and it was really good that they did it.
Yeah. No, that was really fun. So they get into the bunker and they go to the Gray Books, but Donovan has other plans, right? Because he's going to go to that room that Catherine gave him. And so that's where we kind of leave things. You know, Louisa shoots at him, trying to get him to stop, but calls her bluff. Louisa, a lot of commentary about her hair color change, which I thought was pretty funny too, from Douglas. I mean, just another thing, right? Where he's just so funny. I really preferred your natural color, you know, gets into...
It was so random.
Really fun stuff.
Yeah.
But jumping back a little bit, we get Nick Duffy, his scene at Chieftain. And this is like, he just, you could tell the actor there was reveling in that moment because he just gets to go on a total like hard man kind of moment there, putting the fear of God into all of these corporate suits and wannabe spies, right? I thought that was great. You could see he was just chewing the scenery in that scene and was totally eating it up, right?
I think that's Chris Riley, if I remember the actor right. And he's incredible in that role. Another example of perfect casting. He just fills that character, fits him like a suit, and as you say, he's evidently having a really good time with it. I don't know if you've seen, but Oldman's wife is doing a lot of behind the scenes photography that's popping up on social media, and there's a lot of pictures of Chris Riley just in hysterics behind the scenes between takes. He's really enjoying that role.
I haven't seen that. No, I'll have to look that up. That's great.
Yeah, I'll send you some links.
All right. No, for sure. And I also love his flunky, who's just kind of following around and just like messing with stuff. He's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, his flunky, but he's loves having the power. You can tell that.
Yeah. He's very dense and very savage. But yeah, quite entertaining.
And so the reason that he's there is to gather all these Chieftain guys. They're going to go down and pick up Donovan and his crew. But as we talked about with Tierney, she's putting the pieces together and realizing, because early on when Donovan is talking to Catherine, right, he mentions that there's somebody in the park that's helping them. And once Tierney realizes who exactly this guy is and who he's working with, all the pieces start falling into place, right? She realizes that she did have something to do with what happened to Allison, despite Catherine saying that, you know, MI5 doesn't kill their own. Maybe in the olden days, but not necessarily now.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's another thing I like about Tierney, is that she'll have these Machiavellian machinations to alliterate overmuch, and then they'll go sideways. But then she's very, very good at sort of thinking on her feet and re-steering the boat, as it were, to not so much to her own ends, but just to survive.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that across these last couple of episodes, and she just plays it so well. Was it Sophie Okonedo?
Yeah, she's great.
Again, yeah, legendary actress and just fantastic in the role.
Yeah, no, she's really great. And you can see, like, I mean, we get her at the end, but before that, as we see her down in Molly Dornan's domain looking for these files and realizes that they've been sent to the facility that Donovan's trying to get into, and she's like, okay, yeah, you can just see the look in her eyes that she's putting the pieces together and realizing that this guy's not after the Grey Books anymore.
No, that's good, because I mean, for the three episodes, it's been focused on the Grey Books, and you see the whole conspiracy stuff in the previous episode, and so it's not until this point that you realize, okay, well, that was basically a cover for what he's really after.
And Tierney realizes that she's going to need to go scorched earth here, because there's no way that she's going to make it out of this right now. She's like set up this whole plan that she's actually fallen right into the trap that was laid for her, right? I mean, that's the thing that's crazy, that you realize, well, wait, this was all figured out long, long before by somebody who that could be, you know, they don't say, but it seems pretty clear reading between the lines who's actually pulling the strings here.
Yeah, they do. And as you say, she walked right into it.
She did, right? And so her answer is to just kill everybody that's in the facility. Again, what a cliffhanger ending. You know, they do this great thing where, you know, she say, you hear though a voiceover of Duffy telling them that they're going to go in there, kill them all, and to take no prisoners, with flashes of everybody in there on the screen. And just like, wow, at the end of that episode, you just got chills, right? You know, you're like, this is really, really bad.
And we already know from the first two seasons that, for the most part, nobody or no character's life is sacred. You know, there is the risk of losing someone that you've become really attached to. So it creates some very serious tension at the end of the episode.
Yes. Yeah. No, definitely not feeling good for River, Louisa, and certainly not feeling good for Douglas, who now I've come to be heartily invested in his continued living. So I'm really kind of nervous now.
Yes, definitely. And of course, of all of them, none of which are terribly well equipped, he's the least well equipped to deal with what's coming.
He's got his cameras, but beyond that, no. Yeah, I don't think he's going to be able to talk his way out of this one.
I think you're right. Yeah.
His filing skills I don't know. Maybe he can find, he knows a file where there's some old guns hidden or something. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe, but, yes.
But I'm not feeling too hot right now about him. So, yes.
No, definitely not.
We also get some foreshadowing of some great lamb. I mean, we get some here, but like you get this. Okay, this is going to be even better. Like a Roddy Ho Jackson Lamb road trip. I mean, come on. You know that's going to be comedy gold, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the dialogue between those two, is always rich for comedy. And yeah, that's going to be something to look forward to.
Well, and we see Roddy's ride.
Yes.
With his license plate, Big Rod. Everything you would imagine Roddy Ho's car would be, right?
100%. Yeah. And now, you know, just like the book, really, this season is also starting to demonstrate the extent of Roddy's self-delusion.
Yeah.
It's gradually becoming more and more evident.
From his thinking that he has a chance with Louisa to, you know, his choice of vehicles, he's just completely clueless, right?
100%, yeah.
Well,
yeah. Charming for it.
Yeah. This is obviously a car he's had for a while, and yet he acts like he doesn't even know how to drive it. It's like, what are you doing, yes, man? And I love the screen that he has in the car that starts up with, like, some anime, like, warrior, yes, woman. You're just, yeah, like, what is this guy doing? Oh, dear.
Yeah, definitely.
What else about this episode did you like? I feel like it was really setting things up for just an action-packed finale.
Yeah, it definitely was. It's interesting because in a way, it was a bridging episode.
Yeah.
But often when you have a bridging episode in a show, it's disappointing because you think, oh, this is kind of fillerish and let's get on with the plot. But this was not that at all. It was sort of just flipping from, okay, we've had the build-up, so now we're going to approach the climax. And that was the sort of tone of the episode for me, but it was so full of great character moments, as you were saying earlier, that I think, you know, that made it not feel that way at all. It didn't feel at all fillerish. One very minor thing I thought was quite funny is Roddy's car in the adaptation is the Subaru Impreza, of course, but that's actually a slight upgrade from the car that he has in the book, which is even more. Yeah, well, in fact, it just is plain mundane and ordinary. so they gave him a little bit of cachet for the show.
Yeah.
But it was great. What I love about the way they adapt all these books is that it's faithful, but it's not slavish. And there's enough additional elements brought in and enough changes made. It keeps those of us that are very familiar with the books and passionate about them, but it gives you a new experience to watch the show without it no longer being an adaptation. You know, this episode demonstrated that as much as any of the others.
Yeah. Also, they're so good at the one-liners and still keeping the dramatic action. People talk about dramedies or whatever, but I feel like this is walking that line where you're caring about these characters. There is these moments of drama, but they can't resist adding in these great one-liners and handing them out to everybody like candy. And it doesn't matter. It works.
It does. It does. I actually think that's the key to the success of its humor. You know, we use the term sitcom from situational comedy, and it's got sort of a bit appropriated over the years to sort of mean, you know, more mainstream one or two camera comedies. But this is genuinely, the humor does come from either the situations or the personalities of the characters. And that's why I think it's funny without undermining the drama and the overall seriousness of the show.
I agree. This episode in particular was that, right? I mean, this was all about putting these characters together, having them interact with each other and seeing what happens. And I think that was what made this episode so strong, is some of these great character moments that we got, whether it was Catherine talking with Donovan or Louisa talking with River or Lamb and Ho and Marcus and Shirley, even Nick Duffy in the chieftain office, seeing these characters kind of bounce off each other and have their moments, I think is the strength of this show. I think, you know, the book series especially always shines when Heron takes characters and kind of mixes them up and has characters that haven't really interacted very much interact with each other. And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing this episode, right? Is they're kind of shuffling folks together to see what happens.
It shows you as well how well written, both by Heron originally and Will Smith and the other writers in the adaptation, that the characters are so well defined as personalities that you can mix and match and get a completely new and wildly entertaining dynamic. It's a credit to all the creatives that that works so well.
I forgot to mention that we see that exactly when River is talking to Louisa about sleeping around. You know, he's talking about that conversation that Lam has, and then Louisa takes it like not quite the way. I don't know if this is like a defense mechanism on her part or if she really did think that was what he was getting at, where you think Lam and I had a go at it in the cupboard or whatever. And
yes,
the look that River gives to her, like it's like a triple take of disgust that is just so, so funny.
Yeah, it's clearly not the visual that anybody would want.
Well, you know, and then, you know, Louisa's trying to justify her not really caring about Min's death or being passed in the end. River's just like, you're right. You're in a great place. Never mind.
Yeah. How can I get out of this gracefully and quickly?
Yeah, no, it was really quite funny. Just, I can't let us go without talking about this one other moment where, you know, Lam is meeting Tierney at the church. That this is the church that we've kind of now got as the spy church, right? Because we saw that after, I think it was after the first season, right? When they go there.
Yeah, with, trying to remember if you said in the first season, obviously they go there with Min.
Right. Maybe it was just with Min. I feel like there was another time in the first season, but...
I agree. I think it was seen in the first season, but I'm forgetting the context.
But I do love how he goes there and she's trying to talk him into that and he's not having it. And he's like, the last time I had to do the cleaning up from the park, I ended up going to a place with a severed head. So, you know, no thanks.
Yes.
A throwback to the first season, which I thought was really amusing. I love that they kind of are building on things. And I also really like how, because this is the third season, there's, I think, 8 books out there already, they can really layer in some foreshadowing for some things that they know are going to happen down the line. And they've been doing a lot of that this season. I'm not going to spoil stuff for folks who haven't read the books, but just to know that they're able to do some of that stuff because, you know, Heron obviously was writing these books as they came and didn't necessarily know where he was going, but here they do know where they're going, and so they can really kind of layer some of those things in there. For viewers who are paying attention, that will really pay dividends down the line, I would say.
Yes, yeah, 100%. And yeah, you can see them working on that. It's interesting enough, our mutual friend Beth was interviewing Gary Oldman and Jack Loudon, and she said to me, she interviewed them yesterday, and she'd said to me earlier in the week that she was going to. And I think you'll remember this is the second interview she's done with them. And she said, have you got any questions, again, that you want to ask? And I said, well, the obvious question, you know, what's going on with the books beyond number 4? And she said that they said that the negotiations were well underway to adapt the remainder. So we can heave a collective sigh of relief that all of that foreshadowing work is going to pay off.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I'd read some interviews, I think it was with Will Smith, where he's already kind of breaking down at least the next 2 after that, 5 and 6. So I'm really fingers crossed that we get more because it feels like everybody that's involved with the show is just having a blast.
Yeah, totally. And you and I had always said, you know, when talking about the books a couple of years or more ago now, that this was the book where an already great series just goes into the stratosphere, and this adaptation for me is doing the same thing. I mean, the first 2 are great, this one's next level, and we know that there are some more next level entries in the series out there, so yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of folks who've read the books feel like it's either like Real Tigers is their favorite or Spook Street, which is the next book, is their favorite, and so just these 2 seasons here, I think everybody is super excited. I can't wait to see what happens in the next season and how they do that adaptation as well, because I think there's some fun stuff that folks, if you haven't read the books yet and you finish this season, you're going to want to go out and read the next one, I feel like.
Yeah, I definitely agree. They're probably the best advertisement for the next book in the sequence as well as their own next season. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed each season's adaptation, and this one is no exception. And yeah, this episode has some fantastic character moments in it. It really does.
Anything that surprised you about this season so far that they've done differently?
Well, the spider thing was a surprise, and a surprise in a different way was, I don't know whether you would call it an Easter egg or an homage or whatever, but the whole play with Oldman's portrayal of Churchill and that famous line, I thought was fantastic. It was so funny, and I do like that. I mean, a lot of the incredible Lam lines that we're hearing are not in the book. They're products of the writer's room, as you know. but they're so in character. We know Heron's in the writer's room, but you know, it's an evolution of the foundations he laid with the character. So there's so much great original stuff coming out of it, and that is a bit of a surprise and a pleasant one.
Yeah, I think all credit to the writers on this, that they really do seem to get the series and don't have a problem figuring out how to turn it into television, which is not easy and very rare, to be quite honest, that you see a book turned into a show that's so close to the source material and keeps the spirit of it so close without kind of messing it up.
Yeah, I agree very much. I mean, the most recent Le Carre's have been very good in that regard, but, you know, very, very different type of material. And as you say, yeah, it's rare, and I'm grateful for it. It's also, I think it's rare that a show receives pretty much universal praise. In fact, you know, in this day and age, it's rare that shows receive praise at all. You know, people sort of so negatively. But I mean, all the reviews I've read are great. And just as with the books, you know, when I refer the show to people, it's always the same reaction. Oh, this is fantastic. I'm so glad to have picked it up. So yeah, I'm grateful for that.
It's kind of a dual-edged sword being on Apple, because I think obviously they've dedicated the resources and the money to make a just standout adaptation, but it also means that just the number of people seeing this show, that it does have this just huge outpouring of enjoyment from the audiences. It's just, it's not as big of an audience, right? So there's just that aspect of it that's a little sad.
Yeah, that's very true. I wonder if they're going to do a physical media issuing of it. I've forgotten which show it was, but there is another Apple show that they've just done that with. So I thought perhaps they'll do the same thing with Slow Horses. And then, of course, that'll widen the size of the audience.
I mean, it does feel like, you know, I know they want to keep it exclusive, but after a few of the seasons are out there, I do wonder if you just license the first one out there just to be kind of like that thing to draw their people in. Because it does feel like that kind of show that would work well with, because people will get addicted once they start watching it.
And of course, the other thing is there's no sort of merchandise out there for it either, because the fact that it's on an Apple platform, and as I said earlier, because of the photographs that are popping up from Mrs. Oldman and others online, I'm thinking, well, this is a well photographed production behind the scenes, and you know, I think they make a fantastic making of or coffee table book for the likes of you and I that enjoy that kind of thing. So I'm kind of hoping that we might see something like that down the road as well.
Well, from your lips to God's ears on that one, I would say that would be great to see. Yeah. Especially just given the fun everybody seems to be having in the show, you got to imagine that a lot of that translates to some of that behind the scenes stuff as well. And I got to think these are the first seasons like done post COVID, I would imagine. So I would think that some of that is a little easier now, and in that interaction and that fun is probably less confined than it had been before. So
that's true. Yeah, that's definitely true. It's interesting, because you were the person that researched it, I think, for Netkind in general. But when you go down there and see the actual Slough House building itself, it's interesting to see how they've kind of fiddled with the geography a little bit down there for cinematic reasons. And obviously they have to redress the street when they're filming because of the location of the Chinese restaurant, amongst other things. But I did also notice when you watch other scenes around London that they're digitally replacing road signs as well. So a lot of the locations, it's not as if you can sort of look at the backdrop and say, oh, I'll look that up on Google Maps and go straight there, because oftentimes the street name's fictitious. So
yeah,
I'm sure that's to stop fan persons like myself going and being a nuisance to the people that live there. But it does show you the degree of care and attention that goes into the show.
Yeah, well, and the whole thing is the fact that they use the real location that Heron had picked is so wild. That they would go to that length to do that is pretty crazy. But also just the fact they obviously still use plenty of movie magic to get other locations. Like the park location is actually filmed, I think, out in Greenwich at the Royal Naval College over there and stuff like that.
Yeah, the Naval
right?
College. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's the same college that you see trashed in the second Thor movie. It's, yeah.
Yeah. So I love that. Well, they do use that one location. They do definitely kind of mess about with some other stuff. So that's fun.
Yes, they do. And presumably, you know, the Slough House interiors are all sets. And obviously, there's the interior of the park itself. And those are substantial sets. I mean, they have to, I think really they're going to have to film everything back to back before they strike the sets, because you wouldn't want to have to reconstruct those even if they're modularized. They're so big, it would be an enormous undertaking to have to break them down and reconstruct them again. So that's good for us, because it looks like they're going to have to go to the end. And of course, Oldman's talking about retiring after this. So let's just make sure that we get into at least book 8, yeah. By which time, of course, at least book 9 will be with us. So.
Yes. Well, and you know, I mean, I think that's the other thing, is that you can tell Oldman is having so much fun when he's doing this, right?
Yes.
He's just, and I talked about this last episode, like he's just like getting grubbier and grosser as the seasons go on. So he's just like leaning into it in a way that is pretty fun.
In fact, and talking again about the behind the scenes thing, there's a really funny picture somewhere on Instagram of the Jackson Lamb dirty vest and underpants laid out for him in costume. It's really funny. But yeah, he is. You're absolutely right. The other thing that I think is spot on, and I actually read a piece about this yesterday, there's basically one farting incident per season, I've noticed.
Yeah.
And they use it very judiciously, which is good, because I think if you did it as much as you see in the books or read in the books, it would get overused and would cease to be amusing. But it seems like when they break the book down, it seems like they pick the right place to have the farting episodes, you know.
You feel like they go through and they pick 5 spots and then they cut it down to 1 just to figure out which is going to have the maximal impact.
Yeah, and it surely does. It's always very funny, and the lines that come afterwards are great.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this episode. I really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you for inviting me. I always enjoy it.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap things up for this episode. We will be back next week with a look at episode 5. I'm excited to see what happens. I haven't watched it yet, so I'm going to be on pins and needles until I do. So we'll see how that shakes out. If you want to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show, feel free. It'll help some other folks find it. And you can always follow me on Twitter or X or whatever it's called, at Barbican Station, or drop a comment. Just go to slough.house, and that'll take you to the site that I have, and you can leave a comment on this episode page. And let us know what you're thinking about this episode in particular. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Exploring the works of John le Carré, each episode of the Le Carré Cast looks at a specific novel or an unexplored aspect of his life and work. Join us as we take a deep dive into the world of espionage John le Carré has revealed. Search for Le Carré Cast wherever you listen to podcasts or at lecarrecast.com. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.